and happily, erroneously, that Eleanor Holmes Norton was not going to be here. That was my information. And I might tell you that I'm only 5 feet one, and I almost was a head shorter. They always tell me I'm standing in a hole somewhere anyway, but I don't expect I need to take even a half a minute of Eleanor Norton's valuable time. Let's get with it. Okay. The chair of the EEOC, Eleanor Holmes Norton.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Sisters, and I even see a brother here and there. I don't know where the announcement came from, but they'll have to do more than get me stuck in an elevator to keep me away from here. But that's what happened. Have no fear. With all due respect, the EEOC is probably as important to the future of women as any government agency represented here today. Its mission and its mandate is directly, in one fashion or another, but directly and absolutely and deliberately to improve the position of women in American society and to remove handicaps that flow directly from their status as women. I want to take a few minutes to discuss both the problems and the possibilities of this invention that was not very easy in coming. At the same time, and before I do so, I think it only right to say that the essential bases of sex discrimination in America today remain untouched. That is to say, we have not begun to address the essential bases. In that respect, we are somewhat different in our approach to race discrimination. Some of the essential bases of that, for example, tests that are not job-related, we have begun to get to an essential basis of what keeps blacks so firmly rooted at the bottom of American society. But if we look to counterpart bases that keep women anchored in that same part of society, the picture is discouraging indeed. Let us take two issues that seems clear are at the very root of why this large group of people who span all the income classes and all the races and all the talents, and therefore you might expect to be somewhat evenly distributed among society, why does that not occur? They, after all, are different from blacks and Chicanas and Asian Americans. Women are not necessarily handicapped. Most women are not. Those who are handicapped, we know who they are. Why then do women's patterns of employment so closely parallel the patterns of people who have indeed been stepped upon and actively oppressed the way black and brown and Asian people have? Huh? What accounts for this? Well, the issues such as sex stereotyping and comparable worth of work, which point to the cause of this massive underclass of workers that women represent, simply have not been addressed. Take sex stereotyping. Women in this country are confined to about a half dozen occupations, and we can all name them. There's service work and clerical work and household work and teachers and social workers and nurses, and I defy anyone to go much beyond that, because the society hasn't allowed us to go much beyond that. So that of the dozens upon dozens of job occupations which have soaked up people, women remain narrowly confined to half a dozen. Here today, despite Title VII, despite the fact that you have EEOC and the Office of Contract Compliance and this one and that one, these patterns are untouched. Worse, these patterns have deepened in our lifetime. There's a widening wage gap. When my mother came north and became a teacher 40 years ago, the wage gap between women and men was less than it is today. The concentrations in the female occupations when she came north were less. On the average, the female job categories show over the past generation about a 5% increase in women locked into those occupations, instead of a relaxation and a horizontal flagging out into other occupations, women are compressed even more than they were before. I don't want to go into all the reasons for this. One of the reasons is clear, and that is simply that women have come into the workforce in such large numbers, a workforce which is so rank with discrimination that workforce has been willing to soak them up only in a narrow range of occupations. If women had not had to work, in the sense that we now know that the housewife lifestyle is disappearing in America, never was a lifestyle for black women. But to the extent that it was a lifestyle, and it was a predominant lifestyle in the last generation, for white women, it's going, gone. Because the American standard of living simply cannot afford idleness. At least idleness in the way in which America values work, and that is whether or not you get paid for it. In order to accommodate the American standard of living today, it simply takes two wage earners. Knowing that women of all kinds have come out here into the workforce, but since they have not been absorbed according to talent, their wages have been depressed, and they have concentrated and over-concentrated in the traditional female occupations, becoming nothing more and nothing less than a new source of cheap labor for the United States of America. Yet, where are the cases? Where are the guidelines? Where is the work on sex stereotyping? We are still going after ordinary kinds of discrimination, the kind that is most apparent, like pregnancy discrimination, which is deep and widespread, but again, obvious. We do not even systematically attack discrimination of the kind, for example, that we found when I was in New York. We issued a probable cause finding that was this thick against NBC. A settlement has since come out of that, several million dollars, in which one of the findings was that a third of the secretaries at NBC in New York had college degrees. If a man had walked into NBC with a college degree and asked to be a secretary, they would have called Bellevue. That's the mental hospital. When women walked in, they not only accepted them, they steered them with their college degrees. Secretarial work is marvelous and fine, and it's greatly skilled and undervalued work. But if a person has gone to study whatever and has come into a major corporation with a degree identical to that of a man, then she ought to be channeled to the identical place he is channeled. But for a case here and there, these issues are just lying there, fallow, unprobed, despite all your fancy equal opportunity mechanisms. Or take another issue, about which even we do not have consciousness, comparable worth of work, where a highly skilled secretary who can type 80 words a minute, who can take stenography, which is like learning a foreign language, and her job will be scaled lower than a man with an unskilled job working the same plant. That's the way the American economy works. That is, at the moment, unchallenged. EEOC has a major contract out to a consultant at the moment simply to try to arrive at standards for determining when work is comparable. we know, and major corporations will freely admit, that when job categories, particularly around the time of World War II, were set up, they would slot the categories in and then give them value based on whether or not those jobs were designed to attract women or men. It's initially how they got slotted in. Talk about past discrimination built in. And yet that pattern is found absolutely everywhere across the American workplace. No place is free of it. If that is attacked, you will blow the top off the American workplace. It's not an easy issue, by the way. You can't simply go in and say, I'm as skilled as you're as skilled, so therefore we get the same pay. It has to do with market forces. It has to do with all the ingredients that go to value work. For example, if your job has to do with bringing in money, conceivably it could be of a greater value than a job that does not, in fact, draw dollars. Maybe, maybe not. There. Very analytical work, very technical work. But the fact that the EEOC only now has a contract out to establish standards says that we're only at the threshold of this major problem. I mean, women still talk about equal pay for equal work. Well, now, that is a marvelous and fine issue. And all over America, women do not get equal pay for equal work. But women themselves do not even discuss this issue. It probably plagues 90% of the female workforce. And that is whether we get comparable pay for comparable work. Well, these frontier issues and others that aren't so frontier remain unexamined. There's another issue upon which there is low consciousness that I've just directed that guidelines be prepared at the EEOC on dangerous workplaces. We're just beginning to open factory jobs to women, you know, jobs that can triple your wages with no more skill. And yet we live in a society so controlled by chemicals that there is a fear that a fetus might be damaged if women work close to certain chemicals. And so you can, of course, understand what the reflex reaction of companies are. Exclude all you people from all those jobs. I mean, you might be past menopause and couldn't have a baby if you wanted one. You may give all other kinds of assurances, but without some guidance from somebody, employers know an easy way to deal with the problem. All of a sudden, this job becomes an all-male job. This is particularly tragic since factory jobs, lucrative factory jobs, are this kind of just beginning to open to women. Well, the point is that the agency to which I came only yesterday, June 6, 1977, was simply not equipped to take on issues of this dimension. The decline of the government's lead anti-discrimination agency was particularly dangerous when you consider how unpopular this mandate is in the first place. The society doesn't want to deal with discrimination at all. So when you let the lead agency decline, you can affect the quality of human rights itself. We were in danger of that. I felt I had to set out to completely overhaul this agency, that piecemeal reform had been tried here and there, had proved highly ineffective. In my judgment, the machinery had to be taken apart and put back together again. The case processing systems were built for another period, for low volume. They were built for a period when you had to go out on the street and beckon people to come in and file a complaint. Now this remedy has become so strong. The case law under Title VII is one of the strongest case laws in the history of federal statutes. The vehicle for delivering that case law, the EEOC, is what is weak. The reforms underway at the EEOC now conform to the recommendations of all of the respected analysts who study the agency, the Senate and House committees, GAO, the Civil Rights Commission, all of whom have told the truth about EEOC, that it, despite its auspicious beginnings, and EEOC stands apart from every vehicle for civil rights the federal government has ever thrown up, in that it was willing to take risks. Thank you. It was willing to take risks and to go to court on issues where the law was not clear-cut. It was not confined to narrow interpretations, and EOC's very strong beginnings in the 60s have somehow been lost because of its failures in the 70s. But the fact is that its guidelines and its amicus briefs and its interpretations are the reason why the courts interpreted Title VII as a broad and liberal statute. But you can't live in your past. Time marches on, and EOC did not march on, so we got to take it by the hand. I am fortunate indeed that in my career I've had the experience of being a civil rights lawyer on the one hand, and the experience and a strong management background on the other. Too seldom in our society are women enabled to get management experience. If ever anything is reserved for men, it is managerial experience. But let me tell you something. What makes the world go or stop is management. And what certainly will make the EEOC go or stop is its management. Some of you know that I had run an agency in New York that did not accumulate backlogs, that in fact concentrated on systemic pattern and practice work. I believe that I could transfer some of these systems and techniques to the federal agency, although the scale involved here is enormous, and although the conditions were somewhat different. We are now, at this moment, testing new case processing systems and management systems in 3 model offices in Baltimore, Chicago, and Dallas. We had these systems in place for testing 3.5 months after I got to office. The EOC staff, I warned the first day I came, were going to be put on a time frame that was nothing short of vicious. And I could only apologize that they had to get caught within this time frame. But I felt very much like an ambulance driver. When the patient is in extremis, speed up. If the cop tells you and you tell him somebody's having a heart attack in the back of the car, not only will he let you go, he'll probably give you a police escort. Well, I needed a police escort. This patient was very, very sick. And when it is sick, women's rights cannot be far behind. That we could not afford. The early signs from these new systems are most encouraging, and I'm going to share some of the early data with you, data that's not been shared to any audience before later on. We expect to nationalize this system throughout the country by the end of this fiscal year, fiscal 1978, that would be by October. The comprehensive reform in the agency has 3 parts. First, there is functional reform, priority reform, the construction of entirely new case processing systems first, and the integration of lawyers with investigators. In the EOC, the lawyers were housed one place, and the investigators another place, if you can believe that. Then there was headquarters reform. Headquarters, people in Washington are there to service the field. If they don't do that, then there's no reason to have a headquarters. So we had to change headquarters as much as we had to change what went in the field. And finally, there was field reform. To put offices where our workload is a priority, given the backlog this agency has accumulated in the past. These new charge processing systems are 3, a rapid charge processing system, a backlog charge processing system, and I must confess my favorite, a systemic charge processing system, because it gets them in big ways. The fact that we now have 3 systems, or are testing 3 systems, is a repudiation of the notion that one gross and unrefined charge processing system can accommodate the complexities of Title VII work today. Let's look at the rapid charge processing system. EOC was inclined to take your complaint if you came off the field, if you came off the street, so long as you could talk and had 2 legs. The intake was taken by clericals. This flies in the face of professional human rights work. In New York City, the best investigators in the agency were the intake people because they framed the charge for all the rest of us. We were stuck with what they got. Moreover, they had to have a special facility to deal with people. If you're not going to take a charge which is not non-jurisdictional, if you're not going to take a charge which is frivolous, and particularly if you come from New York, you better know how to handle people who you're sending out in the street. So in this job, you had to have all manner of talent. At EOC, it wasn't that people didn't have the talent. It was that job was slotted in as not even a professional job. We have first professionalized the intake so that the people who take charges are full investigators and professionals, the way everyone else in the agency is. They do pre-charge counseling to refer people who do not belong in our system. It is a travesty. It is a lie to the public. It is a tragic circumstance to take the charge of somebody whom you know may remain in your system 2 or 3 years, only to come up with a finding that this case was so beside the point in Title VII terms, maybe, you know, slightly colorable sex or race charge, but no professional, any professional could have seen that this was not a complaint appropriate for Title VII. To take that charge and let that person believe that for those 2 or 3 years something was happening for him. Somehow the EEOC regarded that as benign rather than venal. When people come to an anti-discrimination office, they come with their hopes up. Sometimes they are enraged. They're always hurt. If this isn't where they belong, they deserve to be headed where they do belong. When you take a non-jurisdictional charge, or a charge that's virtually frivolous in Title VII terms, by the way, and put it alongside a sex stereotyping charge or a race charge based on testing, and you handle them as if they are equal, well, then you are not a truly professional agency. You don't deserve to be called an equal employment agency. And yet EOC, with its chaotic systems, was doing that. It was just carrying over old history. EOC, in fact, in the 60s, because they never knew what Congress would do, in fact, had the broadest sense of what a charge was, because it felt that if it couldn't show inventory, the Congress would cut its appropriation. Long after Congress said, if you don't cut your backlog, we're going to spank you, they continued to operate on this theory. It shows you about bureaucracies. They don't change of their own accord. You got to change them. And nobody changed it. So it just went on into a mad system, accumulating charge. You got a charge, we'll take it. It really was a robot system, except that its consequences were tragic. Already we see in the model offices what careful counseling and careful intake can mean. There's been a 26% drop in new charges in Chicago. We recognize that when word gets out that EOC can handle charges quickly, that our intake is likely to go up astronomically. But at least for the moment, we're getting reductions in these offices. I haven't gotten any letters from charging parties saying, oh, y'all didn't take my charge, you're terrible. No congressman has written me saying, oh, y'all are turning people away. You know why? Because they sit with people for an hour, and they talk with them, and they care about them, and they help them find some place to go. People don't come to the EOC to be fooled. If you can't help me, can you help me find somebody who can help me? And that's what they're doing. They're giving a lot of time to people whom they're turning away. The interview is very professional and comprehensive. A good intake interview should get you halfway into the investigation. When somebody takes some time off from work, very often sacrificing part of a day's pay or a day's pay to come down and file a charge, you ought to be getting everything you can extract from them. Every single thing. You ought to be getting all that it will take to prove his charge, and you ought to be extracting those things which go against his charge, so that you can have some sense of whether this ought to be settled. or whether this charge in fact is strong or weak, and if it's weak, what it will take to buttress it. But to simply take a charge and give it a docket number and send the person home. No system that works that way is human. But probably the most exciting part of the new rapid charge processing system is the face-to-face fact-finding conference. As a lawyer, I can tell you that part of the mystique of our trade is that it's better to deal with people across formal legal paper. Somehow they respect you better. So that EEOC and most civil rights agencies got involved early and continue to be totally steeped in paperwork habits. They send a copy to somebody and they ask them a whole set of questions. And the respondent gets his piece of paper that asks him everything about his business. And he looks at it and he says, I wonder how long I can sit on this piece of paper. Let me try 6 months maybe. Why should this be my priority? And so it hasn't been his priority. And as long as you give him that advantage, he'll want to deal with you with paper for the rest of his life or the life of that charge, for I must tell you, age kills even the best charges as witnesses fall away, as opportunities for settlement melt out from under you, as even charging parties fall away, so you can't even find them. The same information which it used to take months and years to get by sending papers back and forth and badgering the respondent is gotten within 3 to 4 weeks when a fact-finding conference is set. It may take one or two or more fact-finding conferences, but a fact-finding conference, in our experience, is an infinitely superior way to get facts over sheer paperwork. Fact-finding conference is not a hearing. I spoke before the Bar Association on Thursday in New Orleans at a big conference they were having, and I told them that I was pleased to inform my brothers and sisters at the bar that we would not put upon them the burden of speaking at the fact-finding conference. Most of the people who have lawyers are respondents. Respondents have lawyers at these hearings. Complainants very often do not. So we said, don't worry. We're not going to make you work very hard at the fact-finding conference. This is not a hearing. We're not going to let you formalize it. It's only a way to get out the facts, and lawyers cannot speak. You can advise your client. You can whisper in his ear the way Burt Lance's lawyer whispered in his ear before the Senate but couldn't speak. That's exactly the role of the lawyers in this conference. Otherwise, the whole thing gets formalized, and somebody jumps up and says, I object, and the other person jumps up and says, well, I double object. And then we're into the madness that we're only now trying to get out of. Fact-finding conference is an informal conference. Let's sit down. What do you say happened? Fine. What do you say happened? Facts come out, the note-taker takes them. By the way, fact-finding conference is a terrifically exciting experience. For one thing, when people are face-to-face, they don't say quite the same thing. They write down. The respondent is less likely to say that Miss X was the laziest employee he ever had. And for that matter, Miss X is less likely to say that everybody knows that I was fired because I was a woman and he's a sexist of the first water, because when they're sitting there, if she says, yes, I was fired because of a woman, everyone knows of his negative attitudes for women, and they ask for his side. He may say, is it not true, Miss X, that you have, for the last 6 months, have had the worst lateness record in the office? And she may have to say, well, yeah, that's true, but everybody knows you're a sexist. Well, the fact finder is beginning to sort out the facts here. The interesting thing about fact-finding conferences is they set the way for settlements even in weak cases. When a respondent is faced with limited liability, he very often makes a choice. He does this in other areas of American life, that he would rather get out of the system early, even if he believes he has no liability, than mess around in it much longer. If it's an anti-discrimination agency, he might really make that decision even more so, because if you mess around with the anti-discrimination agency, they might get to your books. They might really find out how awful you are. And maybe you didn't discriminate against this one, But there are 200 up there, you are discriminating against. So he thinks it over, and he says, I know good and well I didn't discriminate against this person, but I don't know. This charge could, in trying to prove discrimination, even though they're not going to be investigating the whole company, I'll have something to say about that when I talk about systemic discrimination, they may yet, in order to prove against that I'm discriminating against this woman, they may have to look at a much wider area. So he calculates what his risk is. He does it all the time in contract law and tort law and the rest, and he brings the same mentality to this law. Thus, we find that cases which could not possibly have survived the more torturous traditional case processing route often end with what we call a no-fault settlement, because all of this takes place before finding. And when parties are sizing one another up and when they're getting a sense of what, in fact, might emerge here. In New York, 50% of our complainants got remedies before finding through the fact-finding conference no-fault settlement mechanism. Now, fact-finding conference has two purposes. The most important purpose is to get the facts out.